Hey, welcome to the Afikta podcast. Today's episode is going to feature a conversation with journalist Dalal Muawad. It's moderated by me, Mikey Mhenna, and it was originally recorded on Zoom on June 9th. Hope you enjoy the episode.
So I'm very, very pleased and honored to be joined by Dalal Muawad, who is a journalist and Associate Press senior producer. Thank you so much for joining. Dalal is a Lebanese journalist, currently working as a senior Middle East and North Africa video producer at AP. Previously, she worked as a regional video producer for United Nations Refugee Agency, covering displacement in the Middle East and the world. She's also been part of teams at Al Jazeera and LBC International, where she mainly covered human rights, refugees, and environmental issues. She has a master's degree in international political economy from the London School of Economics and a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University in New York, where she graduated with honors. Dalal, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your experience with us. I think the first question that I'd like to start with is a really simple question. How did you find yourself being drawn towards the world of journalism?
It goes back to when I was really, really young, to be honest. I always wrote about things around me, things that I experienced. It might sound, very common, but I had this little diary. And I used to write to my parents and to my friends and write about my feelings. And then as I grew up, I started, experiencing different things and meeting people and seeing things around me that maybe did not seem right or, that triggered certain emotions. And I remember that the first piece I wrote, I didn't know that I wanted to be a journalist, but I was on a school trip and we visited a center for disabled children. Mm-hmm. And I remember having these like mixed, emotions and feelings and being sad. And I told my teacher I wanted to write something about it. And I did, and it got published in the school newspaper. And throughout my teenage years, I felt like I wanted to use my voice to write about other people who have no voice. So, it started with this little story about disabled children, but then it turned into all kinds of topics. And when you grow up in a country like Lebanon, where there are so many issues, you go through wars, you are personally affected, you see injustice everywhere you go. There are events around you that triggered that. And I really went into this with one vocation. That is, being the voice of people who are voiceless, as cliche as this might sound. And unfortunately, the media spectrum was so polarized, it was so politicized, it was really dangerous to be a journalist. When I was in my in college, when I went to AUB, I wasn't 100% sure that it was the time. So I my undergrad had nothing to do with journalism. And I kind of kept postponing this decision. As I was telling you earlier, my parents were discouraging me. There were journalists that were being killed for being outspoken. And then one day I saw something. It's an issue that again triggered feelings and emotions, and I got angry. It was just in front of my office. I was working as a researcher at the National Democratic Institute in Beirut. And there was this beautiful old heritage home that was being destroyed, and I was wondering why. And I got really angry and I was like, this beautiful gem, well, what is going on here? And I started doing research, and my boss, who unfortunately passed away a few weeks ago, told me, you know, this is what's going on in Beirut. I see a lot of these houses being demolished and destroyed. And you know what? Maybe you should write something about it.
Yeah.
It was too much pressure on me. But then I was like, yeah, why not? And that was my first actual piece of journalism. I wrote about, the title of the article was A Lost City. So it's talking about how, you know, Beirut was losing its identity. It was published in Now Lebanon. It was in 2009. And as I was telling you earlier, it got picked by one of my favorite publications. It's called Le Courrier International. And it's a publication that I used to read when I was in school. And I was like, oh my God, like this is me in Le Courrier International. And I felt like this was a sign that, you know, I should really pursue wanting to be a journalist.
Yeah.
And so I started writing and then switched careers and went to Colombia, although I already had a master's. So, and again, like it wasn't easy going to Colombia because when you have a full-time job and you already have a master's and you don't have money saved and you go to your parents and you're like, oh, listen, I'm going to switch careers now at 25 and are you happy to help me, you know, to go to school again? And then they say no. And so, yeah. But I'm glad I did what I did. I mean, it was very obvious to me that this was where my passion was. And
yeah. So I'm curious. I mean, you said a couple of things that, that spur a bunch of questions. Like one, for you, it seems like journalism directly comes out of some felt obligation for advocacy, right? This idea of I want to tell untold stories and advocate for people without a voice. Or even, I guess, like even buildings without a voice, so to speak, like speak up for those who need speaking up, for those who need a voice. Do you feel like your colleagues all feel the same way? Is this a, okay, yeah. Because
no.
I don't think that that's the case.
No, not everyone gets into journalism for that. I mean, some people want to be in politics, like they want to cover politics, they want to cover security. Some people are in art, you know, it's different. And some people even believe that, you know, as a journalist, you might be giving a voice indirectly, but you are not an activist. I'm not an activist. I'm still telling stories and I'm respecting, you know, the professional boundaries of being a journalist. But yeah, I went into this with a purpose, and I don't think, just like being a doctor or a humanitarian worker, to me, journalism is more than just a job, and it requires a lot of sacrifice and it takes an emotional toll on you. And it's not easy being a journalist. And even my other colleagues who don't believe in what I believe in would tell you that it's not easy being a journalist. So yeah, to me, it's more than just a job, and you can create your own purpose or no purpose, like no specific purpose, you know?
Yeah.
To me, there was a meaning to what I was doing, and it was what was driving me, you know, to do what I was doing.
Yeah. I think it's a challenge for journalists in the region in particular, but maybe it's a global challenge, but in the region in particular, to maintain impartiality, right? And to sort of not be seen as activists and not be seen as political entities. How have you managed that? How have you sort of how have you maintained not being the story and sort of have the story be the story?
It's the way you tell the story. You know, it's what the basics that you learn in journalism school. I don't believe in objectivity, to be honest. No journalist is objective, because even when you're like the angle of your camera, or, you know, the soundbite that you pick in an interview, or the angle of your story in general, what you choose to have in or out, how you write it, this is all subjective. I think what you do is you try to be balanced. You have all sides of a story, right? You give everyone a voice. Your opinion is just not there. But I care about a subject, so I write about it. And I know that indirectly, you know, I am helping the people who are concerned by the story. So you don't have to have an opinion I mean, this is not journalism in yeah. that. But it's really how you tell the story, basically, that, you know, differentiates you from other people who, unfortunately, yeah, you can clearly see that they do play the role of an activist in, yeah. you know, in their reporting or in their storytelling. I mean, it's a very thin line.
It's a super thin line, yeah. It's
a very thin line, and it really depends on the media outlet where you're working, because some media mm-hmm. outlets would let you cross that line and some wouldn't.
Yeah.
The AP, this is never going to happen. This is
yeah, one the AP is like the pinnacle of don't cross the line. Yeah.
Apolitical, independent, you know, news agency. And then it depends on the news agenda of the media outlet, because then you can cross the line on certain issues and not on others, right? So
yeah.
But as a journalist, it's really the way you tell the story that differentiates you from other people.
Yeah.
I mean, not writing it over, so.
Yeah. I'm curious how you got into video journalism in particular, because they're, you know, written and video journalism are very clearly different media. And the medium dictates so much about what you're able to tell. You've done some really, really compelling work in video. I'm curious if you were just brought into that because you moved into Al Jazeera, or was it a conscious choice? I want to move into
No, that. It was a conscious choice. So I started as a print journalist, as I told you, like I was just writing. And when I wanted to do the career switch and go to Colombia, I applied to the broadcast program, because yeah. I believe that, okay, I mean, I can acquire writing skills and I can improve, but I wanted to learn technical skills. And I really believe that image is more powerful than anything else. No matter how thorough, how good your text is, there's something that you can convey in an image, in a video, especially mm-hmm. video, because it's not just, it's an image with sound, right?
Yeah.
That's the most powerful message that you can convey. Yeah. So I went for that medium consciously, because I knew that was the best way to tell stories, in my opinion. Not that the other mediums are not, but what happens nowadays is you don't really specialize in anything. You have to know how to do everything. The market requires you to be, you know,
yeah,
write, shoot, edit. But yeah, I'm specialized in video, and I made that choice.
Yeah, so I'm...
There are many questions. Should we answer them now or later?
No, I'm gonna keep them towards the end, because I want them to ask them themselves okay. in their voice and be able to adjust. Because so we'll get to the questions for sure. But everybody, keep asking the questions. Of the journalists I've spoken to, you're a little unique insofar as you worked for a UN agency as a video producer, trying to tell the stories not for any specific publication. Can you just explain what that means? Just as if you were speaking to, you know, a teenager, what does it mean to work for the UN as a person yeah. who's a trained journalist?
So I worked for a UN agency that cared for refugees specifically. So what I would do is I would go on the field and I would tell the stories of refugees and displaced people around the world. And that video that I produce, that story that I produce, mm-hmm. would get distributed to media outlets. So it would get published on actual like news agencies yeah. and media outlets, but it also goes on the UN platform. Was that your question? Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Yeah. The question is, I guess it's a broader question, and I think I know the answer to it, but the question is why?
Why go to the UN?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. Here's why. I was really, really interested in the refugee story. The UN headhunted me actually when I was still at LBC, because it was 2014, 2015. It was the peak of the influx of refugees into Lebanon and the Arab, the host countries in the Arab region. It was also at the time when refugees were making their way to Europe.
Yeah.
And I was one of those few journalists who were really telling the story of refugees from a human interest perspective. And looking at them as, you know, individuals, human beings who've been, you know, who had to flee their countries, who've been through so many difficulties. I did not look at this from a political angle. I did not look at this, you know, from a populist angle, like other local journalists were doing. And, you know, I was very, they used to label me the refugee reporter at here in Lebanon, because I covered all refugee stories. I was the first one in Arsal and the first one in the Bekaa. And, and they thought I was biased towards the refugees. And I was like, how can you be biased towards refugees? I'm biased towards human rights, maybe. I'm just telling their stories. And the UN offered me the job, you know, telling me, would you want to join and keep telling the stories of refugees but from around the region? So one, I was interested in the story. Two, I wanted to go more regional, broader. I didn't want to stay like local. I felt like, you know, my storytelling about refugees could, you know, go to a wider audience.
Yeah.
I really believed in their cause personally. Yeah. So yes, I was biased towards refugees if this is what they were saying. And it paid well. The job paid well. I'll be very honest with you. I was really tempted by, you know, the package they offered me. And I wanted to be, to work with foreigners, to be, because I was working in local media for 2 years. And I felt like the team that I was going to be part of had really like veteran journalists, some experienced people that I could really learn from.
So in that time, what did you learn about the sort of broader refugee story across the region that you didn't know before going into it?
You were just talking about blind spots. I think there are many blind spots in the media narrative of the refugees. There were too many negative narratives, too many negative stories. Refugees being depicted as something very abstract, like a mass, like a group. Figures, facts, and it's very dehumanizing. What I wanted to focus on, and I try to do that, at, you know, in my job at LBC to a certain extent, but I could do much more at UNHCR, was really to tell these individual stories and to focus on empowering positive stories that are desperately needed in the media narrative. Because there was an audience fatigue. People were sick of these negative stories. I mean, if, you know, there are all these difficulties and issues related to refugees, no one wants to host refugees if you don't see them in a positive light, you don't see them as contributors to your society.
Like this one you have up here is really a good example of that.
This is where I saw that, you know, there was something different, there was an added value, there was room for me to work differently. And with the UN, you're not working for a news agency or a media outlet, so you're not in a rush. You can spend time with your characters. You can go in depth with the stories. And although maybe the end product looks a bit like what a news report looks like, you do the work of a documentary filmmaking.
It totally makes sense. I mean, for me, I found it really interesting as I sort of was diving into your work to get a sense of like, the one thing, just because Africa is sort of a historically geared program, I'm curious, how has the refugee story, the capital R, capital S refugee story, changed in this century versus last century? Are there stories that haven't been told or that need to be told or have been told but not many people know about it across the region? Like over the last
century, we weren't that connected and we weren't able to share stories the way we do now. There was no internet. There was, I mean, later at the end of the 20th century, there was, but social media, you know, finding stories was more difficult. It's very easy now to find stories because of the way we are interconnected. And I think the positive contribution of refugees has not been highlighted enough in the media narrative. And this is why you have all these misperceptions about refugees being a burden. They're always depicted as a burden. But I have told, I have, and there are many others who did too, you know, so many stories about refugees who are innovators, who are contributors to the economy, who are, you know, social innovators. They were helping others when they needed help. It's just, I've met people that will inspire me for the rest of my life, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the strength they find in all this hardship and all this misery, it's, there's beauty in their pain, as you know, as horrible as this might sound. They were really, really very, very inspiring. And there's a lot of resilience that you don't see unless you sit with these people and you spend time with them and you tell their stories. And really, I think this resilience is like understated in so many ways.
There's two other broader communities that I want to talk to you about, because I feel like there's a through line in your work that focuses on them. One of them is migrant workers. It seems like a big part of your work, or at least your emotional headspace when it comes to your work, focuses on migrant worker rights in Lebanon and throughout the world. How did you start doing that work? How are you doing that work now? If you can talk a little bit about that, that would be useful.
This is an issue that I actually started reporting on when I was a local journalist.
Yeah.
And really, I didn't realize how big the magnitude of the problem until I started working on it. And I heard the stories of these domestic migrant workers and, you know, this neo-slavery system that is called kafala and that exists only in the Arab world, the sponsorship system. And this is, again, what I said, that, you know, some journalists go into this with a purpose. Like, I went there with, like, I wanted to make something out of what I was doing. And this is one of the topics that I was hoping to have an impact through my storytelling. And, you know, you go through these phases of despair, to be honest, because I'm talking about now, 7 years?
Yeah.
It's the issue, it's like it's a protracted problem, and now it's getting worse because of the economic crisis. And again, it's not just because it's migrant workers that I care about. It's more about, you know, this is basic human rights.
Yeah.
And as a journalist, and I remember very well when we were graduating at Columbia, the dean of our journalism school said that you as journalists cannot stand still in the face of injustice.
Yeah.
And this is me. I cannot stand still when I see an injustice. Okay, I'm not an activist, but I'm going to write about it and I'm going to try to give a voice to these people. And maybe policymakers, the public, you know, the audience, it's going to stir a debate. It's going to lead to a policy change eventually.
Yeah. So if you could just, if I can put you on the spot for a second, because there are a lot of people on the call and in our broader community who are on varying degrees of awareness of what kafala means. So if you could just do almost kafala 101, like, what is it legally? Like, what is the actual legal structure that is promoting and defending this injustice?
So it's, first of all, people under kafala are not under the labor law, okay?
Okay.
So they are under a specific labor law that is called the sponsorship system.
Okay.
Through this system, and this might sound awful, but this is really in a nutshell what it is, your employer owns you. As in, you cannot quit your job if you want to quit your job. Also, for your employer, if he needs to fire you, he will lose a lot of money, because employers pay huge amounts of money to these service providers, bureaus that exist around the country, to be able to recruit these people. And as a worker, you come, you rarely read your contract before you come. It's not even translated into your own language. You are told there are certain working conditions, you end up with other working conditions that are most of the time worse, and you can't do anything about it. It's a very, very meager salary. If your employer doesn't pay you, you can't do much about it. And that's what's happening now, is there's an economic crisis. These are workers that used to get paid in dollars because Lebanon was a dollarized economy with a pegged exchange rate. Now people don't own dollars anymore, and they're not paying their workers, and the workers can't do anything. And what happens is that most of the time, because you can't quit your job, you run away. This is what they say. They ran away as if you're in prison, right? Like you only run away when you are in prison. So they're running away, and and a lot of them live in shelters managed by NGOs. Now there's a crisis at the embassy of the Ethiopian embassy, because Ethiopian workers are protesting there. They want to be repatriated. And it's just horrible because you work 24/7. You live in your employer's house. You don't get a day off if your employer doesn't want to give you a day off. Your salary is really, really nothing compared to the long working hours. You can get abused. You can get raped. I've heard stories of abuse and rape that are horrible. And you know that the system is terrible when statistics say that two domestic workers commit suicide per week in Lebanon.
Wow.
This is insane. And yeah, it's an abusive system.
So is it in the decade of in the decade that you've spent sort of working on this and chipping away at this, are there politicians who have sort or policymakers who have started to buy in and to start to realize this is an issue? Do you feel like on Main Street, so to speak, more people are willing to actually march and say this is not good?
Yeah, only recently. So in terms of policymakers, not this Minister of Labor, but the one before, started a dialogue with a lot of NGOs, and he promised to amend the system. And he was, you know, asking them for an alternative, labor law for these migrant workers. It didn't go anywhere, as far as I know. It was still like a dialogue. And then you know how like you have governments change very often. But yeah, on the street, we saw that in the uprising, in the protests since October. You have graffitis in downtown Beirut, saying, we're all for the rights of domestic workers, abolish kafala. But not enough, Mikey. I was in a protest last year, and most of the protesters were foreigners and journalists. I didn't see a lot of Lebanese, or there were Lebanese who worked in NGOs, like anti-racism movement, CAFA, all these NGOs that... So not enough, and people don't speak up. I've been in horrible situations in my life. Like when you are sitting in a restaurant and you see a woman with a domestic worker who's not sitting on the table while that woman and her family are eating.
Yeah.
And I can't stand still, as I was just saying, and I just can't shut up. I mean, the activist in me just burst, and it's just, I can't. It's, it's an existential crisis for me to be around people who are, living through these conditions. And so, yes, I've tried to use my voice and my work to shed light on this, just like I did with other groups. So, I mean, this is one of the issues that I've worked on.
How did you first start working with the LGBT community in Lebanon and regional reporting on them, reporting on that? Story.
Just like migrant workers when I was at LBC, because this is right, we're talking here about local issues that are very specific to Lebanon. It was another community that I thought was marginalized, that did not have a voice, and that was misperceived, and just the narrative that's out there in the media is just not right. It's one side of the story, or it's a completely distorted image of the story. These are individuals who are usually depicted in Lebanon, including by the media, as parias, as sick people, as abnormal, as, you know, they have no rights, they should live in the shadows, etc. So I did a few stories with LBC, and I made some contact with local activists who were working on the topic. And I still felt after I left that, you know, this was still underreported on, and you know, more work needs to be done on this specific community, especially from an Arab journalist to an Arab audience.
Yeah, I was going to say
are a lot of the documentaries and stories that have been done by the foreign press. And those two are not, they don't really depict the image as is. Also depicting Beirut as this rosy, very liberal place where, whoa, it's like LGBT rights. I don't think that's accurate either. With UNHCR, I worked on LGBT stories among refugees because UNHCR is a big advocate for LGBT rights.
Yeah.
And, you know, they protect refugees or individuals who've been persecuted based on their gender or sexual identity. And then I decided, you know, I wanted to do some more, and I started doing more research. And that's when I met a transgender woman in Tripoli in the north of Lebanon. And I decided to tell her story. And I did like a short film that's about 5 minutes long.
Is it that this one that we're looking at?
On Deraj, yes. It was published back, I think, last year. And I spent a lot of time, you know, it's not easy telling these people stories because you need to gain access to their lives. You need them to trust you. They've been persecuted. They've been living in the shadows for so long. So they, you know, it's not easy for them to open up. And now I have a lot of friends, not just contact in the community, I mean, in Lebanon. And yeah, I'm working on a documentary, actually. So after I did my short film about this transgender women, yeah. I pursued my research and I, you know, stumbled upon a character that I really admire, and she's a friend now. And I'm trying to actually work on a long form feature documentary about her life.
Great.
And I'm partnering with a co-director because I haven't worked on a feature film before, so I could use someone's, you know, experience.
Yeah.
And we're at the stage where we're applying for funds through producers and a production company, so I hope that sees the light.
That's great. That's very exciting. Dalal, I'm going to ask you four Afrika questions, and then we're going to open it up to everybody. So very quick, rapid fire. What are you reading or watching right now?
Oh, good, because I just started watching and reading something yesterday. I'm reading All the Lights We Cannot See. It's a Pulitzer Prize novel. Okay. And I'm watching The Young Pope. It's a series by Paolo Sorrentino, which I'm a fan of.
Great. If you could shadow somebody from the past or present for a day, who would it be?
From the past, Frida Kahlo. I'm obsessed with that woman.
Nice. Why are you obsessed with her?
I think she symbolizes everything I believe in terms of feminism. I consider myself as a feminist. I think, you know, she was a pioneer feminist in many ways, but I also admire, you know, all the beauty that came out of her pain and, you know, her hardship. This is a woman that suffered a lot, and yet, you know, she was able to produce art and make beautiful things. And
beautiful.
Yeah.
What do people most misunderstand about your work or your profession?
I think they underestimate the emotional and psychological toll of this job.
Yeah.
They just don't get it. It's very hard to be in a refugee camp for a whole week at the border between Greece and Macedonia and to come back to your nice house with a garden and to live your life as if, you know, or to be in a war zone and the next day to just, you know, normal, going to the movies. The emotional and the psychological toll you know, it's because you get, you know, you meet people and you go into their stories. It's tough.
I saw you posted at some point about like the PTSD associated with reporting in conflict zones. I never lived in a conflict zone, but I was a public school teacher in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans for a long time. And like, there was so much work done around PTSD for public school teachers in those types of situations. So I very much relate to that.
Yeah, and journalists don't realize that there's a, I realized that there's a form of passive PTSD, because mine actually started as a passive form even before I went on the field, because I spent a whole year at Al Jazeera English on something that's called the Syria desk, dealing every day with like 50 videos coming in from Syria, talking to activists on the ground. I was really sitting on my desk. I was safe in Doha, but it got to me. And
Okay, last one. Whose work do you admire or are inspired by?
Well, that's a broad question, but I'll mention a journalist because, you know, this is what I do.
Sure.
Definitely Lise Doucette from the BBC, their chief international correspondent. I admire that woman, and I really believe in journalists who've spent, you know, most of their careers on the field. I think these are the, you know, the good journalists.
Okay, great.
You learn so much from the field.
Dalal, I'm going to open it up to everybody. Dina, I think you're still on. We're going to start with you. If you could keep it to one question, that would be great, just because there's a lot of very good questions. So Dina, if you want to unmute yourself and ask the question, go ahead.
Thank you both so much for this. And
Hi,
how are you? I'm glad you started talking about the queer community, and I was wondering if you could speak more about the Queens of Beirut documentary. Maybe how it came about, or...
Yeah, so this is the documentary that I mentioned. I am looking at the story of a woman who actually nurtured the drag queen scene in Lebanon. There's a thriving underground drag queen scene in Beirut. And I was lucky enough to actually follow the development from the beginning. So we're talking about 2.5 years ago. So really, I was looking for a positive narrative about the queer community. As I said, I feel like these are the blind spots in the media narrative. And I was amazed by these, you know, young queer people who were actually using art and performance to express their identity. And despite the fact that we still live in a country where homosexuality is criminalized, and, you know, there could be a police raid at the club where they're performing, they could be, you know, persecuted just, you know, for doing what they're doing. But they're doing something very smart, because they're going on stage and they're using art. And I think this is how they're protecting themselves. And I thought that, you know, through this story, I could tell, you know, some individual stories of queer people in the community who have had their own struggles and who really depict the struggles of the community. So yes, this is a positive and empowering narrative, because these are individuals who are doing something, you know, and who are resisting the status quo in a very creative way. But at the same time, of course, as I said, not everything is rosy and happy and easy. That I would tell, you know, their personal struggles. And this is why it's called Queens of Beirut. Now the film's name might change, so it's up to the producers. But when I got the funding from AFAC, that was the name of the film. And the film follows a specific character, but there are also other characters.
Thank you. Hi, Dalal.
So you can unmute yourself.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, we hear you perfectly.
Okay, great. So I had two questions, but I'll ask this one. I think, you know, as you said, you don't, you know, it's very subjective world, the world of journalism. It's not always objective. But I think there is truth. And I think part of the work is uncovering that. And so in this increasingly blurred fact media environment, how do you find, check for, uncover truth in your stories?
Yeah, truth is the ultimate objective, of course. It's easy and it's difficult at the same time. I never publish or, you know, put out something I am uncertain of or something that I have not checked with at least two independent sources. I mean, this is the basics of journalism that you learn in school. And then definitely not repost or republish something I have not checked myself, at least not on a professional account. And then I always go to sources that are considered credible, sources that I've worked with before, that I always go to, because you need to fact check your source before you fact check what they tell you. So yeah, was that your question?
Yeah, I think so. And I think maybe more than that, do you have to ever go beyond that? Is that enough? Are there moments where you're having to dig deeper or investigate a little bit more?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it depends on the issue. There are things that are, you know, you can easily check. And others, you know, especially in Lebanon, there's no access to data. It's very, very hard. You always have to rely on informal sources, on, you know, secondary data. So it's difficult. And this is why, you know, building credible sources is essential in a place like Lebanon, whereas maybe in the US, access to information is much easier. So yeah, you sometimes have to dig deeper, and this is the basic formula, but sometimes, you know, it requires a lot of work, and it might put you in danger. It might, you know, you try to be ethical because sometimes to get to a piece of information or, you know, to a source, they ask you weird things, you know, it's just like, is this ethical? Can I do that? Yeah. You know, people have asked me for money. People have asked me for a day. People who've asked me, you know, for something in return. I mean, these are no-nos, right? But yeah, the few investigative, I think in investigative pieces that I've worked on also, it's not just fact-checking with sources, is you immerse yourself in the story. You embed. Right?
Yeah.
And so you get to know the people, you get to know the story. It reflects your own experience of that story, of, you know, of that issue you're working on.
Yeah.
So you also trust your own experience with that.
Dalal, just to add one last question onto that. Who in this space regionally is doing really good work on data that, you know, like, help empowering journalism, empowering journalists? Are there research institutes that you find yourself going back to over and over again because they're doing really solid work?
There are the international ones, and there are, yeah, some, it depends really on the issue, but like the universities, like I've used a lot Aysan Faris Institute at AUB for data and facts about refugees. You would be surprised, although I was at UNHCR, but even when I'm not at UNHCR, they have a great, professor who wrote, you know, a book. So yeah, mainly universities. So AUB to me is and especially Aysan Faris Institute is a great place to go to for data. There are, you know, the usual Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, because they do also in-depth research that we, there's the Samir Asir Foundation also on everything that's media related, you know, press freedom. Some foundations, yeah, but it's not that easy in Lebanon. Again, like, we lack that.
Okay, thanks. We're gonna have Laura up next. And I think we have 4 or 5 more questions, so I'm gonna try to keep you to like 2-minute answers. Laura, you're up next.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to ask, so you mentioned some of the high pressurized situations that you've been in. I wanted to ask that, how do you manage stress under those kind of situations? And like, how do you manage to balance your emotions alongside your logic and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Listen, at the beginning, I'm not going to lie to you, I was really bad at managing my stress, and it translated into all kinds of physical, like I had stomach issues, all kinds of things, PTSD. So, and I think part of it was not just because the stories that I cover are stressful and I'm in like these uncertain situations. It's also because I also put a lot of pressure on myself, mm-hmm. because I believe that I have this vocation, that I'm going to use journalism to, you know, to give a voice, to have an impact, etc. It was a lot of pressure, and it kind of turned into despair and anxiety at some point, because I wasn't seeing the results I was expecting. I mean, I did. So first of all, I convinced myself that, you know, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, but I'm going to stop expecting, you know, my stories to change the world. I mean, I'm having the impact that I can have. So you learn what your limitations are, and you realize, you know, that there are so many layers to change, and there's so much more resistance than you believe, and you accept that. So just accepting what are the limitations of what you can and cannot do. And I started, you know, trying to dissociate when I'm done with my job, especially when I worked with refugees. At the beginning, I used to come home. It would be very hard for me to, you know, go back to normal. Like, I would sink into these stories. They would kind of haunt me, and it would get to me. So I also started, you know, I learned how to cope, how to try to dissociate as much as I can. And I also do therapy, to be honest. I go to a therapist. It's been 2 years, and it's helped me a lot. Deal with pressure, deal with anxiety, deal with despair. And I think these are things that were really triggered by me being a journalist, as, you know, as simple mm-hmm. as that.
Well, yeah. you're amazing and a true inspiration. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Dalal. My question, you touched upon a little bit in your last answer, but I came across your work because I was doing research into migrant workers in the Gulf, because I lived there for a while, and I noticed the same things that you brought up about their rights and how they're, you know, exploited. But the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there are so many people who are doing this work, but it's like, sometimes it felt like they were, you know, screaming into the void, because you're trying to like dismantle the mentality of populations that have been this way for as long as we can remember, you know? So I found that sometimes that can be really, really discouraging. So how are you able to persevere and just keep doing the work, even though you can't always see tangible change?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, you don't always see tangible change, but you do see some change. I mean, gradually. Not every story, not every issue you work on ends up, you know, changing or being solved. But I do feel like, specifically on the issue of migrant workers, that the past 2 years, the younger generation is behaving differently. They're more aware of the issues. There are more voices out there who are speaking out against the sponsorship system. This was not there when I was reporting on the issue 7 years ago. So I do see some change, and that, you know, it gives me some hope. But I think you bring up a point that is very valid, and that is to what extent we can keep the same narrative again and again, you know, talking about these stories from the same angle, especially that these are really deeply entrenched in our society's, you know, culture and beliefs. And I think racism is a cultural and a structural problem in the Arab world. So I think what the journalists need to do now, and maybe this is where we should go, people who are researching or writing about this, is maybe looking at a different angle, looking at the story from a different perspective, offering, I don't know, alternatives to the sponsorship system. I don't know, I haven't thought about it, but now that you're mentioning this, I'm like, maybe we need to tell that story also differently. It's the same with the refugee story. I at one point, I think, you know, what UNHCR and the comms team was trying to do is to change the narrative, because there was a fatigue about, you know, all these negative refugee stories. So maybe we should do the same. Maybe we can also convince the Lebanese that the sponsorship system is bad for them, because it is. It's not just bad for the workers, it's also bad for the employers. They pay a lot of money and they're also stuck in a contract and with an employee they might not like or want to have. Maybe if we show them there are alternatives, you know, we can change, you know, their mind about this, this system. So yeah, maybe we need to look at the story differently.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks so much. We have three last questions. Dalal, if you're okay with that, we'll go in order.
Yeah.
So we have, who's next? Rula, are you still on?
Yes. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. So thanks. This has been really great to listen to this. It's my first time tuning in to Africa.
My question, Dalal, is really, it's because I think that to the feminist in you and to the professional woman in you, and I think a lot of women, especially in our culture, feel like they have to balance so many roles at one time, and a lot of time the career is what gets sacrificed first, especially if it's one that involves risk or uncertainties, like I think, you know, your journalism career involves. And I think your parents, understandably, you know, didn't really encourage you at the beginning, given the line of work you wanted to go into. So what is your advice to women who want to, you know, do more in terms of professional fulfillment, yet they're kind of held back by fear of actual risk or fear of perceived risk in life?
Do not fear that risk. Just take it. You're not gonna, you know, what's the worst case scenario is that you, I don't know, you fail. You're worried maybe if you have a family, your partner is gonna, you know, leave you. I tell this to women, I'm sorry, if your partner is gonna leave you because you have a full-time job and you are ambitious and you have a career, he's just not the right partner. So I think the first step is actually to get out of that box that we've been put in as women in our very traditional patriarchal societies. You know, get out of that box. Your role is, you're equal. You're just equal to a man. And if you have a family, why is it okay in our societies for a man to travel for work, to be away from the family, to be career focused, to be the breadwinner, and it's not the women? I mean, you need to start, you know, believing that your role goes beyond these stereotypes that society has, you know, imposed upon you. When you believe that your role is much more than that, you're not going to be scared to take that risk. You're not going to be, you know, risk averse. You're just going to go after what you want. And yeah, I mean, that's it.
Great. Thanks so much. We have Muhammad, you're up next, followed by Eric.
My question, Dalal, is really focusing on my experience, because I used to work for 7 years as a journalist in Libya back home, because that's where I was
home. Wow, tough place, Muhammad.
During the conflict and everything, but a perspective that I came to be aware of after starting to work as a journalist and seeing how the national media, meaning inside Libya and outside the Arab media, my question is about, for me, the two main sources of information of news are Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya in Arab countries. But the two have shown biases, unprofessionalism, and also, for me, at least this is my personal opinion, to total disregard to journalistic standards and ethics, like especially in issues concerning Yemen, Libya, which I can attest to personally, the Gulf crisis, that like the both the entities seem like they took sides in some certain issues. Is there a way for other news channels to appear and win back public trust, do you think?
Listen, you are totally right. And I worked for Al Jazeera English, which is better than Al Jazeera Arabic, but it's not only on Libya. It's the Arab Spring, it's Syria, it's both biased, both have agendas, unfortunately. And we don't have, when it comes to regional networks, we don't have an independent outlet that we can rely on to get the truth. I think traditional media outlets are kind of dying, like traditional broadcasters, you know, TVs. So I'm not worried about that. Where I see potential is with independent online platforms that are emerging and that are covering the Arab and, you know, North Africa. Mm-hmm. And by that, there are a few that I can mention, like Rasif, Daraj, Megaphone here in Lebanon. They're really good. And I think a lot of, you know, the young audience is going there. And maybe these are the platforms that could bring out a third narrative, you know, the truth. You know, the problem also is it's a vicious cycle because there's also a financial crisis that the media outlets are going through. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of media outlets have become obsessed with viewership and, you know, how to get clicks per views. And I'm talking here about online, but also the traditional broadcasters, because you don't have advertisement anymore. And even like Saudi Arabia and Qatar at some point, you know, they couldn't spend as much money as before. So it really impacted the content too, and the quality of the content and the editorial decision making. Maybe when the media industry is out of this crisis, I still think they're going through that, there would be also more room for, you know, independent reporting and journalism. But at the moment, I don't see any Arab network that you can really trust. It's maybe some online independent platforms, unfortunately.
Thank you very much.
The interesting thing, Dalal, about this is that it sort of speaks to your earlier point about like business models in general, right? And so if we get to the point where these independent networks scale and get to the point where they actually have to, their business model needs to work, they may suffer the same fate as some of these larger ones as well. So there's an interesting conversation, maybe a conversation for another day about reimagining the business model of large scale media.
I think it needs to be reconsidered and reinvented and really not sustainable, and it's a pitfall because this is how you end up with a lot of political money and business money and all these media outlets.
Let's take our last question from Eric.
My question was maybe a little bit more personal. And, you know, most of your work really focuses on trying to convince the majority of people of the humanity that these marginalized groups that you cover have, and telling their stories. And I'm just curious, how do you stay grounded and keep forward with your work when it feels like things just are not changing or maybe just not progressing quick enough?
Because I know that at some point there is still an added value for what I'm doing. Even if you don't see tangible change, and please intervene if I'm not answering your question, by putting that story out, by, you know, telling that story, you are putting information out there. You are somehow, you know, teaching people something they didn't know. You are changing their perception, maybe, and that's a start. You are allowing these people to tell their stories, no matter where that goes. So, you know, I still believe that what I'm doing is meaningful because, again, I went into journalism because I wanted to find purpose and meaning. So again, that goes back to my personal objective. But as I said, I go through phases of despair and I do become hopeless, and I've been in situations where I just want to give up and there's no point. And especially when you live in a country like Lebanon, where nothing really changes. I mean, change is minor. As there are issues I've worked on as a local journalist 7 years ago, you still see news reports about the same issues today.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God. Like, and I'm grateful that I've been able to move out of local to go regional and international, because then there are other issues and stories to talk about. And you're not stuck in that, you know, in that dilemma of, you know, just becoming, you become redundant. You feel like you're a redundant journalist, just working on the same issues again and again. And as I said, and I that was in my one of my answers, I also taught myself how to accept the limitations of what I do and to try not to go very personal in an issue, because it happens. Like last week when I was working on the domestic workers, the Ethiopian workers, that night I went down and we were filming a story. I mean, I was not filming the story. I commissioned the story, right? Because I'm a senior producer, so I don't always go on the field. I commissioned the stories. I went down. I couldn't sleep at night. I was like calling all kinds of journalists I knew and NGOs I know and just like tweeting and tagging. And I just couldn't sleep. And the next morning I was like, you know, I can't go on like this. This is, I can't do this.
Yeah.
It's just, you have to learn that at some point you stop and you know that, you know, I've done my job and that's it. And you just don't take it personal that nothing has changed. I used to take it very personal. And I used to cry and I used to say that, you know, fuck it, I don't want to do this anymore. Maybe some journalists don't feel this way. It just, you know, I've met journalists who just go, they report and they go back home. I'm not like that. And it's harder. It's like I'm condemned. You know, it's a curse. It's to care so much about the stories that you report on. I sometimes I just don't want to care. I don't want to care. And now that I'm back in news, it's good and bad. It's good in the way that, you know, I'm not only focused on marginalized communities. I mean, I commission a lot of these stories and we try to cover as much as we can, but I do other stuff and I'm trying to diversify, you know, those stories I work on, because it gets to you.
Dalal, thank you so much. You've been such an amazing guest. For those of you who don't already follow Dalal, I've had it up for a while, but you should.
I'm gonna put my Twitter.
She's not posting
the personal, my professional outlet, and then you can also follow me on Instagram. It's of everything. I just want to thank everyone for their time.
Yes.
With us for more than an hour.
This was great.
I know the people that I don't know and that I hope to meet, and I think the questions were great. So
yeah, this was a lot of fun. And Dalal, hopefully we can have you back in the Africa world soon.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, I'm gonna go.
See ya. Thanks for everything.
Bye.
I'll stay online for like another minute if anyone has any other questions. But Dalal, thanks so much. You're the best.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. We have new episodes coming every single week. Make sure you follow us on social media, on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find us at afikra.com for information about all upcoming events. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot. See you next time and stay curious.